So maybe just talking through some of the stuff we're learning in here today with you guys. Now, how many, I mean, I assume you're all doing college ministry, right? That's probably why. But how many of you, like, I don't exactly understand what everybody's, is it like you guys oversee like a chapter that's on a college campus, or like a couple of people just explain to me kind of what ministry looks like in your context?
Really, I work with seventh graders through age 30. So
okay.
College is one aspect.
So college is one thing, and you're in a church. Okay. How many are doing college ministry through a church, and how many are doing through a parachurch? So how many first do like a church kind of a... Okay, see, so you're like kind of overseeing that with interest. And then how many are doing some type of parachurch type of deal? Oh, good, so we got a lot of diversity.
There's another category, too.
Oh, yeah, what?
Those of us who work for denominational judicatories.
For what?
Denominations and judicatories.
Okay.
I work with that state convention.
Judicatories. That's a new one I need to add to my vocabulary. I never heard that one. Judicatories.
Another name for denominations.
I'm gonna sound really impressive next time when I make that category three. Yeah. How many of you work for a judicatory? Yes. All right. Well, let me give you a little background. Axis is what we call our postmodern ministry, I guess, at Willow Creek. It's got different names depending on who we're saying it to, but sometimes it'd be our 18 to 20 something ministry, postmodern ministry. Sometimes we'll call it our Gen Next ministry. But it's just the ministry within Willow trying to figure out who is this new generation? How do we reach them evangelistically? So, I have spent, probably the better part of the last 6 years trying to understand, you know, what has changed over the last 30 years and how does that change our strategy to reach them? And I'll tell you what, you want to know what my biggest learning is? I'll tell it to you right up front. Over these last 6 years of being in church, we're trying to figure it out, is that there's such a temptation to go to books and conferences to figure this stuff out and not figure it out by knowing people who are in this generation. So that's probably number one learning for me. You know, I realized is the more and more I have gotten involved in local church work, and I love local church work, it has been so much fun, but there is a draw in local church work to get you more and more involved in Christian activities. You know, more Bible studies to lead and more meetings to attend and more things to get off the ground and more fires to put out. And while I would say I think God has wired me up to be pretty evangelistic, I noticed a trend, and it really got bad a couple of years ago. I did not have any non-Christians in my life anymore. So I found at Willow, I'm doing all these evangelistic training sessions for our Axis people, and every time I do a training, I'm telling stories in the past tense. You know, so I once had a friend who, or I had a conversation a long time ago with this person, or once I sat on an airplane next to this person. And I realized, gosh, this is so hypocritical. I'm like telling these people to rearrange their schedules and make their priorities in the right order and get around what matters. And it's been a long time since I've actually done that myself. So it was, I would say it's early 99, I really started wrestling with this. And I spent like the next 6 months trying to figure out, where is my place where I can develop some friendships with people that don't know God? Now, for those of you working on college campuses, maybe that's a lot easier for you. It was a significant shift I had to make to say, how am I going to get around people that don't know God? So I joined a basketball league. I did meet some non-Christian guys there, but I just couldn't find a common ground, so I never really developed relationships. Started frequenting the same restaurants, trying to talk to the gas station attendant, anything I could do. And I just was having a hard time. So a very memorable moment in my life. It was December of 99. It was a very wintry night, which incidentally, when I knew I was coming to Orlando in November, I figured Chicago would be 30s, this would be 90s here, it was going to be great. It's actually warmer in Chicago right now than it is Orlando. So much for that one. But it was December of 99. It was a cold night. I was sitting at a Starbucks, very frustrated that I couldn't figure this one out, how to get around people that don't know God. So I was journaling about it and thinking about it, and I said, God, where do I go to meet people in this generation that don't go to church? Yeah. I had an epiphany that moment in that Starbucks. Looked around, thought, all right, knucklehead, there you have it. And further than that, God really pushed me on this one. He said, "Yeah, I want this," not audible voice, but I felt him saying, I want you to rearrange your schedule and not just study at Starbucks a lot. I want you to apply for a part-time job here. So I did. They hired me amazingly. And I've been working two shifts a week at my neighborhood Starbucks for the last 2 years. And man, I enjoy reading Leonard Sweet and Rick Richardson books. I enjoy coming to conferences, and I really do learn a lot at those. But I have learned infinitely more at this Starbucks than I have in anything else I have done. And the reality is, even though we're trying a lot of things at Axis, and I've read a lot of things, most of what I'm probably going to talk to you today comes from these experiences that I've had in Starbucks. And as I've weighed, how Willow has always done things, and what's working for Willow and what's not, and then kind of having my own little mission field at this Starbucks, just trying to synthesize it all together. Okay? Sound all right? All right. I'm going to kind of use this outline loosely. The first big learning I want to talk to you about, and this will kind of be an umbrella for this whole session. You know, when I would be at Starbucks, you know, I was lucky enough to grow up in a church planting family, so I've known about church all my life. Didn't mean I followed God all my life. That wasn't until young 20s, but, you know, knew about Him all my life. So I was very trained in kind of the classic way to do evangelism, you know, kind of the classic evidential apologetic model. So if you can convince somebody first that there's a God, you know, use the ontological or entheological or whatever other argument, convince somebody that there's a God, then take them to the next step, convince them that Jesus is God's Son, that came to die for our sins, and then the final step, that the Bible is God's inerrant word. You know, if you could take them down that traditional trail, somebody would become, you convince them into the kingdom, they would become a Christian. And then Willow takes it even a little bit further, makes it even a little bit easier. And really, the way the Willow model works for evangelism, for those of you who've been there, you'll know this, it's pretty simple. It's their evangelism strategy is develop a relationship with somebody that doesn't know God, share a verbal witness with them, and then invite them to a weekend seeker service. You know, they do weekend seeker services that are trying to do the questions that people have that don't know God. So I get ready to go into this Starbucks, and I figured the only thing that was missing from my life is being around these people. I figured once I get into Starbucks, you know, I'll do this traditional evidential thing, convince them about the truths of Christianity, take them all behind the espresso bar for a baptism service, you know, get them all into small groups. 3 months in, 3 months out, I'd be back to normal life. Maybe you want to guess if that's how it's gone for me at this Starbucks? It has not gone that way at all for me. And so I have really to wrestle with, what is it that's different? You know, are these Starbucks people, you know, are they just happen to be further from God than everybody else? Or are they representative of where people are at? College age, 20-something, postmodern people. And I was trying to understand the difference between them. You know, I'm like, is it unchurched and churched? Or is it they know a lot and don't know a lot? Like, it feels like there's two different kinds of people. One is very open to the idea of Christianity, and they'll come down a path. Some are very not. Then I read this quote by, you remember the old musician Steve Taylor? You know, he was real big in the 80s. He had this quote that was just a random quote in a book, and I've never had like one quote so illuminate a new idea that I was thinking. And you don't have to write this one down, but this is the quote. He just simply said, Gen X is today's first post-Christian generation. So it's not that they don't believe in Christianity. It's that they, or as he said, it's not that they don't know what Christianity is. They think they know what Christianity is, and they decided they don't want any. And like that, I had an understanding of the two different kinds of people I was meeting at Starbucks. So these are written down. The two different categories that I've really seen. I hate to categorize people. I hate being categorized. But with that being said, I'm going to do it anyway. The two different categories I've seen. There's pre-Christian people and post-Christian. Just a definition I'm kind of using at Axis these days. Pre-Christian and post-Christian. I'll give you a definition of both, and you can write these down, and then I'll illustrate what I mean. Here's what I mean by a pre-Christian person. Somebody that's not a Christian yet, but usually they are just one body of knowledge away from becoming a Christian. Right? They're usually just one body of knowledge away from becoming a Christian. Contrast with a post-Christian person, this would be somebody who thinks they know what Christianity is and has decided they don't want any. They think they know what Christianity is and they've decided they don't want any. You got that pre-Christian, usually some body of information missing, that's what's holding them away. Post-Christian, somebody who thinks they know what it is and doesn't want any. Let me tell you, let me paint a portrait of two different people who I work with at Starbucks, and I think you'll get kind of a difference, an idea of the difference between these two. A pre-Christian person, this would be the person who would be reached by a traditional church kind of thing, or the traditional evidential apologetics I was talking about, where they may know a lot or they may know a little, but they're open to the idea of Christianity. All right, so I have a friend, Miyuki, who works at this Starbucks. She's a 28-year-old girl, moved here 7 years ago from Japan, and started working there about, I'd say, 8 months ago. And so I got to know her. And, you know, one of the first things I ask everybody at Starbucks, in fact, every non-Christian, you know, they used to say that there's three things you never talk about, right? I think it's religion, money, and power. Religion, money, politics. That's it. I knew it was a P. Religion, money, and politics. Probably a good idea still not to talk about money and politics. I rarely do with non-believers. But the religion one, I don't agree with that anymore in this culture. I think people are very open to talking about spiritual things as long as you're not going to tell them what's right and what's not. But if you're just soliciting their opinion, I find they're so open with their opinion, sometimes I can't handle it anymore. their opinion on church and Christianity. And so this is like icebreaker kind of question for me now. Almost first or second conversation usually I will ask somebody, because it almost always comes up that I'm around a church or I do Christian things. And so immediately you kind of gauge they're probably a little weird about this. So I always just follow up immediately and say, how about you? What's your opinion of church? What's your opinion of Christians? I always start there. And, you know, they kind of give you that same look, like, you sure you really want to know? And say, I really want to know. I'm not going to judge you. I'm just curious, you know, and they'll tell me. Okay, so I meet Miyuki and I, you know, we get talking. I find out she's from a Shinto background in Japan. Although she only loosely holds on to it. It's just kind of what she knows. So then I get ready to ask this question, which I always brace for. I said, so, you know, what do you think of church and Christians? You know, kind of brace to see what she said. And she goes, huh, I don't really know too much about church and Christians. I'm like, really? That's it? Like, no, hostile, you know, they're condemning, judgmental, intolerant, hypocritical, condemning the hell, you know, the whole list you usually get. I'm like, that's it? That you just don't know a lot? She's like, I don't know a lot. So then I just said, well, do you think maybe sometime you want to come with me to church to see what Christians believe? She went, okay. You understand, my first 18 months of Starbucks, not one person even remotely open to coming to church with me. So when this finally happened with Miyuki, it's like, oh, God, thank you. You throw me a bone at least, you know, something where I don't have to start way in the hole and work my way back up. And Miyuki, I would not even really classify her as a seeker yet. I mean, she's not earnestly asking questions. But she comes with me to church almost every week. I think it's more just because she likes the people there than she does a spiritual message. She comes every week. I'm, with God's help, I'm convinced at some point she will become a Christian. I don't even know what the body of knowledge is that's missing, but we're not fighting an uphill battle. It's just a matter of time before she gets this one. And if most of my friends were like Miyuki, I would have nothing to talk about in this course, because I think our traditional approaches reach somebody who's open to that. But that's not where most of the Starbucks people are. Most of the Starbucks people, if you bring up the idea of going to church or the idea of Christians, they have no interest in it whatsoever. The reasons vary widely for why that is. Let me just give you one story. A gal named Debbie, who works there, actually quite a bit older than me, but still fits this kind of postmodern description. You know, she starts working, and I try my best not to tell people what my other job is at a church too early, because they freak out on me every time, you know. And so I try to let them see I'm a normal guy, two hands, two feet, not sending anybody to hell. You know, let them see I'm a normal guy, and then tell them, well, it's not working very good anymore. Pretty much everybody that works at Starbucks calls me the Starbucks pastor. So they introduce me to everybody, even people who come in. It's funny, there's a pilot there, a homosexual guy who's a pilot, and then me. And so we're like the two most famous people, the Starbucks pastor and the Starbucks pilot. They love introducing us as that. So anyway, this gal Debbie starts a little over a year ago. And she's getting trained on the register. It's a busy rush, so she's doing that. I'm making drinks, you know, trying to keep up. So somebody comes up to her and says, so did you hear what his real job is yet? You know, great, here we go again, you know. And she says, he's a pastor at a church. Debbie gives the typical reaction, you know, looks freaked out. She whirls around in the middle of this busy rush. You know, just leaves everybody waiting in line. She goes, what is the deal with that? I said, go back to work. I'll explain it. And so I'm trying, you know, she starts taking again. I'm explaining how we try to build church services for people that don't usually go to church and that try to respect people's journey and, you know, whatever, just trying to calm her down a little bit. And she's just shaking her head. So I said, you know, same thing I always do. I always follow up and ask, you know, what they think. She said, how about you, Debbie? Where are you at with the whole God thing? She said, you know what? Me and God have a real serious problem. She said, 3 years ago, my 16-year-old daughter was raped and murdered. Now tell me what kind of a God would let that happen. What do you say to that? I mean, you give her a tract on suffering and hope that she figures it out? I mean, like that, the traditional means are not going to reach somebody like her. And while that may sound like an extreme story, there's a lot of those kinds where it is just not as simple as give them a verbal witness or bring them with the church. Got to figure out a different strategy. And most of my people there, it's funny because they're generally spiritually ignorant, if I may say that, yet they think they know enough about Christianity to say they don't want any. And that's a big learning for me, because I used to measure whether they know a lot or a little. It doesn't matter how much they know. You can have somebody know a lot and be post-Christian. You can have somebody know a little and be post-Christian. It's just whether they know enough to say, I don't want anything to do with it. So in a moment, I'm going to have you guys, I want to see what, it may be different in your context. You may have more pre-Christian people than post-Christian. I'm going to show you a video right now that we just did not too long ago in Access. We did a series called Starbucks Spirituality, where we just said, you know, what are the questions people talk about when they're sitting over a coffee? And each week of it, we did what we call a man on the street, where somebody just takes a video camera, takes random samples, questions on the street, just asks. Now, these are not, we did not cut out certain ones to make a point. These are just the people we met on the streets of Chicago and asked them, what do you think about church? And when I'm done, I want you to tell me whether you think these are pre-Christian or post-Christian people. Could somebody back there hit the lights? Would you be willing to do that? Thank you.
Church can be really segregated from the society and racist and sexist. Rigid.
Business.
Untouchable.
Voice of authority.
Domineering.
I've seen a lot of perceptions that, you know, were based through religion that weren't necessarily true. That has led to some people's lives being kind of messed up. My entire life I've been approached to convert my religion. I think it's a very harmful and a bad thing to do. When I was a kid, I used to go to the church a lot, and, you know, my grandmother used to get everybody up, go to church, and we didn't have clothes. We didn't have church clothes. I remember going a couple of times, and the kids, and, you know, would laugh at us, poke fun of us. Even, like, the older members would roll their eyes at us and look at us like we were, you know, like we were garbage.
Yeah, your friends had a bad experience with a priest in a Catholic church.
I had sort of a negative experience with my own religion, so kind of that turned me off to religion in general.
Church is another one that's hypocritical. I think everybody has their issues in church.
Probably goes without saying, what do you think these were, more pre-Christian or post-Christian people? Yeah. Do you? I know I just gave you these definitions. Do you kind of understand the difference of how I'm, you know, all matter to God, all can be reached by God, but starting at a very different place. So here's what I love you to do. You may not even know each other, but break up into groups of two or three. Just spend a couple minutes. Talk about where you live. You know, and there's always a percentage, even where we live. I mean, probably 10 to 20% of non-Christians are very pre-Christian people. Like, they're just an invitation away to coming to church. But that's different than 30 years ago when most people were pre-Christian and open to going to church. It's dramatically dropped over the last 30 years. So there's always going to be a percentage of both. But if you were going to say in your own local context, is 50% or more post-Christian, or is 50% or more pre-Christian? And then it'll be interesting to see. So go ahead now, break into groups of two or three, introduce yourself. Just say whether in your context what you think. All right, I'd love to do a hand raise on both of these. So I'm going to ask pre-Christian first, post-Christian second. Again, there's probably some of both. If you're going to say your people are more pre-Christian or more post-Christian, what would it be? So how many of you say, in your context, they're more pre-Christian there? Okay? A few? Great. And then how many would say our people are mostly post-Christian? Interesting. Yeah, that's how it is for us in Chicago right now. I mean, we are, and again, it's amazing to see how fast things have changed in just 30 years or so, because even within our own church, the older crowd is more pre-Christian. They're still very open to coming to a church. And we're within the same walls of this church trying to reach a totally different kind of a person. Not totally different. I don't want to overstate it. I mean, people are people. But there are differences in a pre-Christian and a post-Christian. And I just go in now, when I meet new people in this age range, like, I go in with this assumption. I go with the assumption that they're open to God and closed to church. They're open to God and closed to church. You know what's amazing? At Starbucks, there's not in the 15 people that work with me there, it's not a single atheist at Starbucks. In fact, I can only think of, in all of my travels, I think I can only think of two atheists I've ever met at college or 20-something age. This is a very spiritual culture. And yet, with the increased spiritual sensitivity, it's more unopen to church than it's ever been before. In fact, the statistics bear it out. Barna says that under 25% of Gen Xers go to church now, which is by far the lowest percentage ever in American history. And it really, I mean, if you go into a conversation assuming that, it totally changes how you go about proceeding. You know, I just assume now that somebody's post-Christian, and if they're not, great, it's just easier, you know, but I go in there assuming that. So, I mean, another example, just, you know, we're in the suburbs at Willow, and so with Axis, we're trying to start an urban ministry as well. Not like a whole church, but just an urban thing that will reach some people in the city. So I've been going to the city a lot more lately, trying to get this group going. And I try to make my ride count when I go out there, so I'll meet with multiple leaders in one night. So we're at this little coffee house right by Wrigley Field, if you've heard of Wrigley in Chicago. And so I've got, you know, one leader for an hour, then they leave, the next leader for an hour comes in. So this girl, 25-year-old waitress, kind of sees these people coming in and out, and she's been giving me a hard time all night as it is. So finally she sits down and she says, "You run like a drug operation here or something? I mean, what's the deal?" And I said, you know, you want to hear what we're really talking about? She goes, yeah, I want to hear what we're talking about. I said, we're talking about what it would be like to start a church here in the city. Now, I'm already assuming she's post-Christian, right? Her expression does nothing to dissuade me from that opinion that she's probably post-Christian. But immediately jump on that and say, now hang on, before you give me that, like, I want to hear your thoughts on this. Because I said, you know what the funniest thing? I said, you know what the funny thing is? People our age, nobody goes to church anymore. And, you know, she acts like she already knew that. She goes, oh, yeah, you know, I believe that. So, in fact, our generation is the lowest church generation ever, yet most people believe in God. She goes, yeah, I get that too. She goes, why do you think that is? I said, well, hey, time out. I'm the one who goes to church. Like, you and your friends don't. Why don't you tell me why people don't go to church anymore? And, the answers are so similar, it scares me sometimes. Everywhere I go, they're very similar kinds of answers. It's either, you know, hypocritical or condemnational or judgmental or legalistic or Ned Flanders or, you know, whatever the descriptions are. That's from The Simpsons, for anybody who doesn't know who that is. But they just, it's just this amazing paradox in that they believe in God and don't believe in church. And it doesn't usually happen this fast for her, but I actually said, you know, we talked actually for about 10 minutes. Again, I find people are very open to giving their opinion if they're not going to get hammered afterwards. So she went on for quite a while telling me her opinion on church and Christians and some of the experiences she's had. And then after she got done, I said, well, with that being said, here's what we're thinking of starting, and try to describe a place where those kind of people would go. I said, I just want to know this. If we started this, and we're not ready for it, but if we started, would you come to something like that even one time maybe? She said, I probably would come one time just to see it. Mm-hmm. So it goes to show you, now my Starbucks people never come, so that's just a one in a ten kind of conversation for me. But I do believe post-Christian people can be reached. I mean, we all believe that. We're here trying to figure it out. But it's a different kind of a strategy. So I'm going to keep firing a lot of information at on the next sheet. You've got, see a couple, one says the Roman method and the one says the Celtic method. The guy who was supposed to teach this with me, he wrote a book called Evangelism Outside the Box. And I've been wrestling with this pre-Christian and post-Christian, but I didn't know what to do with it. And he wrote this book, and it really helped me synthesize our thoughts and access a lot on this. So what he did, and he took it off of a book called, some of it from Wesley, some of it from a book called The Celtic Wave Evangelism. They looked at two historic movements that have reached a lot of people for Christ that happened at the same time, and they reached a very different kind of person. So I want to walk through each one of these, because I would really make a case that the Roman model reaches pre-Christian people very well, and that the Celtic model reaches post-Christian people really well. All right, so let me just, very brief explanation of the Roman model. These both happened, I think, around 600, 800 AD, something like that. Some of the most significant missionary movements that ever happened. The Roman movement was particularly good at reaching people that were open to the idea of church. And it would kind of follow a simple three-step process. Step one was they would make a proclamation of the gospel. All I mean by proclamation is just a bold declaration of who Jesus Christ and the gospel is. A bold declaration of the gospel. That's what proclamation is. Right? And we still very much do proclamation today, right? That's something that will be a timeless kind of thing that we have to do. Now, what would you say, what are some of the ways we do proclamation today? Let me give you an example. Like, a song or music would not be proclamation. That could represent Christ, but it's not boldly declaring something. But a billboard would be proclamation. Does that make sense? So what are some of the examples that churches across the country today, what are some of the different ways we do proclamation?
Street
evangelism, absolutely. That'd be one of the most common ways, right? Like, go, you know, hand out a tract or start a conversation. How else? How else do we do
proclamation?
Yeah, radio. Radio would be another way we do proclamation.
Television.
Television, sure. Any other ways you can think of that we do proclamation today?
Rallies.
Yeah, right. Rallies would be a way we do proclamation. A Billy Graham crusade. Even a church can be a place we do proclamation. Like, that would be Willow strategy. Bring them to church to hear the proclamation.
T-shirts,
yeah, that's right, which I'm sure are very effective, right? Well, I won't make fun of them, sorry. Probably a lot of people here wear those T-shirts, so I need to watch what I say. Yes, right. So anyway, that's an example of proclamation, right? So proclamation is always part of the message of Christianity, but that's where they would start. They would proclaim to a bunch of people, and then some smaller number would be converted based on that proclamation. Right? So some people would go through the conversion portal and end up on the Christian side of things after hearing this proclamation. And then the last part, does it say community there? I use community and connection interchangeably. But the last part then is they would then get connected to a community of believers. Alright, so then they get connected to a small group, to a Bible study, to a Sunday school, to be able to serving with them, you know, to come into church services. But this is key to understand their strategy. It was after they got converted that they would become part of a Christian community. Alright? Now, they make a case in this book, and I would agree, most churches probably still follow this strategy, even if they're not knowingly following it, where it starts with a proclamation to a lot of people, some amount of those will be converted, and then they will get connected to a Christian community. Now here's the question I want to ask. With a model that's based on proclamation first, for that to work, what is assumed?
Prior knowledge.
What do you mean by that?
That they know enough.
That they can respond to the proclamation. Sure. What else is assumed? That they're listening to the proclaimer, right? That there's enough trust built between the proclaimee and the proclaimer that they'll listen to that. So, question: are the college people that you're reaching out to, are they listening to the proclaimer today?
No.
That's what we're finding in Exodus either. No, they are not listening to the proclaimer anymore. And while, of course, proclamation is an important part of the gospel message, if you start there and they're not listening, you are faced with a challenge, aren't you? Will you ask a question or throw?
Yeah. I work for a proclaimer, and so having said that, I think another thing in the mix is a prior relationship.
Yes.
Somebody who brings them.
Yes. Yes.
So I think that's.
Yeah, because anybody who's going to eventually become a Christian is going to have to hear the proclamation at some point. So I'm not at all dissing proclamation. It's just the order in which it happens. And so before I move to the Celtic model, here's the one big word. If you want to hear Daniel Hill's opinion on what postmodernism means, like it all comes down to one word. If we figure this one out, I think we'll have effective ministries. And it's this: trust. Trust. Trust is the absolutely essential ingredient for somebody to listen to proclamation. And I would argue that of all the things that have changed over the last 30 years, and certainly there have been a lot, technology has changed and we're much more pluralistic than we used to be, but I would say all the things that have changed the most in the last 30 years, I think people's trust levels have changed the most. Now, I think you even see this, remove it even from church for a second. When you look at just some of the things that have happened over the last 30 years, you see how much trust has changed, right? So let's think of mail, for example. Go back 30 years ago, when the mailman would come to a family's house, was that an exciting thing or a boring thing? Yeah, it was kind of exciting, right? It's like you wanted to see who was going to get a letter. Did anybody get something mailed to them? You know, the family would gather around. Now, fast forward to today's day and age, where do you tend to open your mail at? Yeah, over the trash can, right? So a lot of us open it. About 3/4 never will make it to you. Yeah, they're right. That's a pretty big shift in 30 years, right? Go back 30 years ago when answering machines first started coming around. What was the original intent of an answering machine? Not a trick question. What was the original intent of an answering machine? Yeah, you didn't want to miss who called. You want to make sure you capture. Now, for those who even have answering machines anymore, what is the purpose today of an answering machine? Screen calls, right? It's a big difference in 30 years. In fact, marketers call it cocooning. They say, like college-age students, when they look at an internet page now, they're already trained to ignore the top 25%. Because they already know it's banner advertising, but they don't even look anymore. They don't even know that they're not looking. It's just part of their reflex. Now, it really plays itself out in church kinds of things, too. And there's no room for your notes in this. So if you just want to write this down somewhere, write trust really big. And write the word broken 3 times under that. So trust. And if you could walk away with anything, I hope it's really this trust idea that you will walk away with. But there's 3 things. There's probably way more than this of why this generation doesn't trust as much. But here's at least 3. For one, I would say, we all know the stats, but broken families is where we have to start on this one, of why trust is so different today. In fact, if we did a hand raising here, probably half of us would come from, you know, some type of broken family. But when your family unit, which is where you kind of form how you believe and think, when you come from a broken family unit, that has huge implications on your pursuit of God. And one of the most common metaphors of the church is the family of God, right? If you say, you know, some well-meaning Christian says to a post-Christian person, well, I want you to be part of this family of God. Is that a good image or a bad image for them? It's a bad image. Yeah, I mean, they didn't mean anything bad by it, but it's probably negative things that come. They don't like being with their family at Christmas. Why would they want to be part of the family of God? Even though we know ultimately that is exactly what they need to find God's love in the family of God. It could be a bad image. You think of God, you know, one of the primary metaphors for God, a God our Father, right? You take some girl who's got a jacked up relationship with her dad, and somebody, some well-meaning Christian says, you need to be connected to God your Father. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, it really has a significant influence. And even though we all know the statistics of this, sometimes I wonder if we really think about how deep the rabbit hole goes on this one. Now, I don't meet post-Christian people who say, you know, the reason I don't want to go to church is because I have a trust issue, and the reason for that is because I'm from a broken family, right? I'm not trying to make it that simplistic, but when you kind of take the thread to its origin, I think for a lot of people, that's the reason sometimes. Second broken one, you see broken churches. Broken churches is another thing that's new to this generation. Now, I would never want to pin this on any one person. You know, we all can fall, and I know I can easy. But there have been a series of recognizable people that have fallen, and it's like common language for a lot of people in this generation to know what those are. So they may not know any Bible verses, but they can tell you all the different black eyes that Christianity has taken over the last 30 years. And I just think the way we respond to things sometimes just doesn't do us any help in what we're trying to do. Have you guys ever heard of the Urbana Conference? It's a missions conference. I went to that for the first time this past year. It was at the University of Illinois. So you got 25,000 Christian students who are called to missions. You have all the missions agencies trying to recruit them into theirs. It's a cool deal. Then you have all these thousands of non-Christian students kind of wondering what all these Christians are doing here, right? So I drive down there. I go to this thing. It's a great session. Coming out of session one, see, there's a group of picketers outside. Oh, geez, you know, what now? You know, what is this? What are they picketing? So I inquire a little bit, find out it's a group of Christians that's picketing the Urbana people. I say, well, what's their problem with the Urbana people? And this group of picketers feels that the church at large, the Big C church, is not taking a strong enough stand against homosexuality. So they decide to pick that venue to picket against them. So I walk out, literally, the first sign I see, it's a life-size sign, a guy walking around, that says, "Friends don't let friends be gay." How tacky, you know? Might as well walk around saying friends don't let friends be liars and friends don't let friends steal. And if you're going to do that, and the part it bothered me enough. But then what broke my heart is I looked around and I saw all these U of I students walking around, just looking as they passed by. And I turned to my friend and I said, "You know what? If I was somebody who believed in God and was trying to figure out how to find them, and I saw this is how Christians related to each other, I would never want to be a Christian." It's just the truth. And again, when you go into a conversation almost assuming some of these things, it helps you think of where do you take the conversation. When I first started at Starbucks, I was at Moody Bible Institute at the time, and so somebody, this girl named Cresta, found out I was at Moody, and she had met a Moody student once. So she walks up to me and says, "So, are you a born-again Christian?" Now, what do you think she's really asking me here? I mean, it's not a, "Can I become a Christian too, and can you show me the way?" She says, "Are you born again Christian?" And just, you know, I'm just kind of still sorting through all this. So in the moment, I just said, "Well, I don't know. That depends." She says, "Depends on what?" I said, "Are you asking me, am I born again Christian like loving and compassionate? Or are you asking me, am I born again Christian like condemning and judgmental?" Which one do you think she said? Yeah, she got a little smirk on her face. She said, "I'm really asking you the second one." I said, "Then no, I'm not. I unapologetically follow Jesus as my guide, but I'm not a born-again Christian, if that's what's in your mind." Yeah, just she's really been shaped by some of these kinds of things and starts in the hole, not a pre-Christian kind of person. Last one, I would just call this broken society. Just lump everything else in this one, but you could talk about the political structure being broken down. You could talk about kind of the abortion trend that has just been the last 30 years. One significant stat I would throw under this one that I think really does affect church work. Jimmy Long in his book Generating Hope says that 1 out of 3 Gen Xers have been physically or sexually abused. 1 out of 3. Now, if you really think about that, that is messed up. And that means in probably just a normal sampling of your people, a third of them are working through that kind of stuff. You know, when I have an access gathering, I look out, I go, "God, help us." A third of these people had a sexually abusive dad or an uncle or somebody was knocking them around. And they have to work through that to try to find you. And that really puts you back. Just Tuesday night of this week, we have a medium-sized group that I'm part of. And there's a guy, it's a really cool story. He's a waiter at a sports bar, and there's a group that's been going to the sports bar for karaoke every Thursday for the last 6 months just to kind of share Christ with people over time. And they're just getting to the place, a couple of them have responded. So this guy, this 29-year-old waiter, has gone through this amazing journey and just accepted Christ. So he's just kind of figuring this all out right now. And he leaves his small group, bolts out. It's a big, masculine guy with tears in his eye. I go, "Steve, what's the deal? What's the deal?" He goes, "Somebody was talking about how they had abuse in their past, and it just brought up all my memories." He said, "From age 1 to 15, I got knocked around every other night of my life. Every other night, my dad would come home and knock me around. said, you know, 15, I hit back, and that was the end of it. He said, but they started talking about this in small group. I'm just on spin cycle right now. I can't even think. And that's where, you know, you'd look at this guy, nobody would ever guess that that's his junk. But that's where he comes from. And there's probably so many more than this, but so many reasons. But bottom line, at some level, trust has been broken. And to reach a post-Christian person, trust must be rebuilt. Just to get to ground zero, trust must be rebuilt. Now, question for you. How do you rebuild trust with somebody? Like, let's say your trust is rebuilt. What is it? Let's say your trust is broken. Somebody talks about you. They steal from you. Like, what does it take for them to rebuild that trust with you?
Time.
Time, really. Is there any other way? Can somebody who badly breaks your trust say something magic in one sentence to rebuild that trust? No. And frankly, any of us who are hoping for that one right sentence that's going to convince a post-Christian person into the kingdom, I just don't think it's out there. Because you cannot microwave trust. It happens slowly over time, usually in one-on-one kinds of things, usually in very small ways. But as trust gets rebuilt, you know, I think somebody opens up to the gospel. So that's the big difference between the Roman and the Celtic. Now I want to walk you through this because, man, I think if we really think through this Celtic model in our ministries, we could really come up with some exciting things to reach post-Christian people. And to give you a little background on this, so the Roman movement is reaching these people. It's got a proclamation-based deal where people come to it. A few get converted and get connected to the community. So St. Patrick, you know, a very famous figure, he raises up and says, you know what, there's a whole group of people not being reached. The barbarians, that's what they call them back then, are not being reached. And the barbarians were the fun-loving, you know, truth is relative, I'm doing my own thing kind of a person. Sound like anybody we know today? Barbarian sounds so rough. I think we think of the big horns and the turkey leg or something, but just was simply the description of these unchurched pagan people that the Roman movement wasn't even touching. And it was a growing group of people. So St. Patrick felt called by God to take the same message but figure out a new way. And this is the model that they went through. And this first one is the key differential between the two. And it's soul awakening events. Yeah, the key thing to understand here is that a soul awakening event is not meant to convert somebody. Like, a soul awakening thing is not meant to convert somebody. What St. Patrick and his boys believed is that every person has a spiritual side to them, even barbarians. You know, in Ecclesiastes it says, God has put the eternity in the hearts of every man. But that many of these people were in spiritual hibernation. They just weren't in touch with their spiritual side. And so they would figure out, what do we have to do to awaken that spiritual side? Not convert them, because that's too big of a step to go from spiritually hibernated to converted in one motion. But how do we spiritually awaken them? So for them, what it would look like, you know, they'd get a group of Christians and just live in the community with the barbarians. And back then, the pub was the center of social life for these guys. Any of you have been to England or Ireland, you know pub is very different than our nightclubs here, right? I mean, it's almost a family environment there. And in the pubs there, storytelling was the key thing that happened back then. People would just get up one after another and tell stories. So St. Patrick and his guys, they would just join the process and get up and tell a story. Except when they would tell a story, they'd tell a story of King David, or of Moses, or of Noah, or of Jesus. And they'd tell them in that language and throw that out there. And you know what they wouldn't do when they finished the story? They wouldn't have an altar call. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but it can be very premature for a post-Christian person. And they found just becoming part of their community, and for them that was the soul awakening kind of thing, that was how in a non-church setting they could get the message of Christ out, had a dramatic effect on these people. So I want you to put on your thinking caps right now even and break back into the same group you were in and start brainstorming even right now. If we were going to come up with some good soul awakening events to reach college-age, postmodern types of people, what are some different kinds of things you think could work that's not designed to help them cross the line? That comes eventually, but it was just designed, something that's just designed to be a soul awakening event for them. So ahead, break in your groups, brainstorm a couple ideas, and then we'll share a few of those. All right, let me hear. What were some ideas you came up with of something you could do as a soul awakening event, or just anything to do soul awakening? That's a lot of talking for nobody having any answers. Yeah.
Community service.
Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. Like serving the poor kinds of things or something like that. Absolutely. Yeah. I think we underestimate the ability of those kinds of things, because if it's true that people are open to God and close to church, it's not God that the problem is with. So if we go do something like serve the poor or help out in the community, I find post-Christian people are very open to that. And that could definitely be an awakening thing. Yeah, what else? Did somebody? Yeah.
Well,
discussing books and movies.
Oh, I think that's fantastic. Figuring out a way to do discussion groups around books and movies that happen outside of church. I mean, people read, people go to movies all the time. They're spiritual people. I mean, I really do believe ordinary average Christian can be trained to do those kinds of things, to lead discussions. And we're going to talk about more of that. But yeah, I totally agree. Any other ideas?
Idea.
Oh, you just got nominated. Oh, sorry, you had so many good ones. Which one to do?
Where they were talking about in England, where they just take kids to play their type of music, bring them together,
mm-hmm.
and they do that for a while, and then they will say, okay, we're going to have coffee afterwards.
Yeah.
Just anything that would allow them to come together.
Sure, so like any kind of a music-based event or something like that? Yeah, absolutely. Any other ideas?
Drama?
Yeah. I guess the trick would be, where do you have the drama at? This is just my opinion. I don't think a church service can be an awakening thing, because once somebody comes to a church service, they're probably already awakened. So it doesn't mean that they're even that close to becoming Christians, but they're in motion now. And that's why I'm not at all dishing an event-based or church-based strategy, because, I mean, we need those too, and I feel like you're best off with a coordinated effort. But yeah, you're always going to face that problem that to get them into the walls is going to take a certain kind of person, and there's a lot more of them that aren't open to that. Yeah?
You go like art openings and discuss.
Sure, yeah, if you could get people to do that, art openings, yeah.
Dinners in your home?
What's that?
Dinners in your home.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a dinner kind of a base thing. Because again, these if it's friendship and you have that kind of trust, you can take a lot of chances in a friendship that you can't take on the street with somebody or something like that. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and you and then...
shows are real popular, like the Survivor.
Absolutely, if you could figure out a way to do...
Conflict,
yeah, that's a fantastic idea. What was yours, Ben?
Wilderness activities.
Yeah, sure. That's so not me, but I know there are people that like that kind of stuff. It would never have reached me, but I'm sure there are people that it would reach. So no, I'm sure that is a good idea. Boy, you guys, those are some very good ideas. And I'd encourage you, I told you the trust thing I think is the biggest thing to get out of this. This awakening one is very tied to that. And I would spend, if you were going to grab your team and think about some stuff, this soul awakening one is one of the ones I would spend the most time thinking about. Because I think most churches and ministries either neglect it, or they almost intuitively understand that it works, but they don't have a word for it. And to just say, this is going to be a significant part of our strategy. And, you know, we're spending a lot of time on our access staff thinking about, you know, we always want to have a great secret service for those who can make their way into it, but what can we do to do awakening kinds of things? And we're going to, our next two ideas that we're going to try, we're going to do, are on the Super Bowl. We're going to try to get 12 different homes, large homes that will sponsor it, and then have small groups invite their non-Christian friends to the Super Bowl with them. Now, even with that being said, one of the trick things about awakening services is there's a lot of things you can get non-Christians to, but that don't necessarily awaken them. You know, so a sports league can be a great way to get somebody in, but like we have not been able to figure out how to turn our sports leagues to an awakening kinds of thing. So we have a Thursday night open gym, and we get more racial diversity and more unchurched people there than we do anything else, which is great, but none of them ever take a step further than that. So that's a key thing in the awakening, is figuring out how to not just get people there, but get them thinking. It's not meant to convert them, but it definitely needs to get them thinking. And then I'm really excited about this one. In May, when Star Wars is coming out, we have a theater right by Willow that holds about 550 people. It's just a real old school theater. I think they get about 10 customers a night, so they're on the brink of bankruptcy, so hopefully they'll last until May. What we're going to do is, in May, we're going to rent out the whole theater and show some of the old Star Wars movies, and have like a little break in there, and then we're actually going to create a little video about Axis that we'll show in there, so it won't be overt, but enough to get people thinking. And we're not even going to make it available at Axis. We're just going to go through our small group structure and say, you have to buy tickets two at a time, one for you and one for your friend that doesn't know God. And I think we'll fill that thing up no problem doing that. So we're trying to, the very same thing, be very creative, say, we need to push past the bounds of just the traditional proclamation methods and think, what can we do that's an awakening kind of a thing? Yeah?
Seems like, and I was involved in the outreach stuff at a previous church, that if anything that a church didn't have some sort of biblical instructional or here's now what you need to do, it wasn't considered valuable outreach or in the process.
Yeah.
And it seems like part of what has changed in culture is that now is a critical element,
yeah,
to the whole discipleship process, even if it doesn't have the altar,
yeah,
call at the end of it.
Yeah. it's a tough one to work through, especially for those of us that come from traditional backgrounds, because until I had words for this, I always felt really guilty when we did things that didn't. I mean, my dad's so old school, and I love it. I love him. You know, we have great conversations. But, I mean, we just did kind of an awakening kind of thing. And, I mean, he was just, you know, he was ready to knock me out that we didn't do an altar call at the end and say, "Hey, you have that many non-Christians there and then not do the altar call. How can you? Paul wouldn't have done that." Yeah, it's always his thing. And I'm glad you have an inside line to him that you know whether or not he would have done it. But yeah. Yeah.
Individual friendship is talking about group events.
Yeah.
I think it's individual.
Absolutely.
People everywhere reaching out and caring for people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how trust is built. It's one Christian to one non-Christian and just over time. I totally agree.
So you can use the big events to draw people in, and secular events to draw people in, and then have part of your team, or I work with international students, so we have Christian students or people from local churches at the event to partner one-on-one and befriend the students.
Yeah, sure.
Not to beat them over the head.
Yeah, I think to really be effective, you know, what's the two primary metaphors that Jesus uses for evangelism in the Sermon on the Mount?
Salt
and light, right? Spent a lot of time lately thinking about, like, just how much meaning there is to each one of those, because they're very different kinds of feels. If you think from a church-based strategy, the difference between salt and light, light to me, I kind of think of the old church on the hill with its light on, you know, that's a beacon of light in the darkness, and something that draws people to itself. You know, something that, you know, breaks the darkness, draws people. And there's always going to be a need and a place for that. But I think we've swung the pendulum so far that that's mostly what we think of as that kind of a thing. Salt is such a different metaphor, isn't it? Almost completely unlike the light one. You know, salt in those days, you guys know this, you know, it was used to curate things. It had to get up close and be massaged into whatever it was going to curate. It took a long time to have its curating effect. And I think to be totally effective, we need to figure out how to do both. We're all at probably different maturation stages in our ministries, but to eventually get to the place where you feel good of, we have a good strategy for sending people out and teaching them the slow trust-building process, and then having some type of a beacon of light that we can also draw them to. I think if you can figure out how to do both of those, you're going to be effective in any context, really. But I think in a postmodern one today, we're just in a culture that knows how to do the light thing, and just we've really just drifted away from teaching people to go out and be trust builders and how to just have friendships one-on-one to do these kinds of soul awakening things. Yeah?
It strikes me that we do all these things in hopes that God, Jesus Christ, calls people to the place.
Absolutely. Yep.
How do you we haven't really talked about the fact that it's, you know, ultimately God is calling people through us. We don't want people to follow us.
Yeah.
So how do you sort of make that turn from the Celtic way or Roman way to, I mean, you know, we can have a great sort of, I don't know, I'm going on and on here. Do you all have prayer groups?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, there's always a danger of, I mean, when you look at, there's a lot of different continuums you could look at. One of them would be strategy and prayer. You could put them on one. Some people, like me, tend to be much higher on the strategy side where, yeah, I know prayer is important. I know it's God's sovereignty, and I probably spend too much time thinking about the strategy. And then you get some who, you know, they think if it's just sitting in a prayer room that will be enough to cause a revolution. And I think it's a mistake to remove either. It's just that my underlying assumption here is that God is the one who draws them to himself. It is his holiness, his sovereignty. He can completely violate the Celtic model to reach a post-Christian anytime he wants. He can, you know, he can do it however he wants. Sometimes it will happen through a tract, which I don't think I'd probably ever give a tract to somebody, and God has probably reached many people through a tract. I mean, there's just, he can do it however he wants, so that's for sure an underlying assumption. I just think it's kind of the adventure he gives each generation is to rediscover the church. And we do our best to kind of put some strategy behind it and figure it out, and then do a lot of praying all the way along and pray that God will do it. And for all I know, 1 year from now, I may totally discard this and say, all right, this isn't how God's working in Axis anymore, and now I need new words to describe what he's doing. So, I mean, I appreciate that reminder, and I do agree with you that it's ultimately his sovereignty. Now, let me finish off this Celtic model, just so you get the last two steps. I wanted to spend most of the time on that awakening. But the second one is very important, too. Back then, you know, so they would do some soul awakening things, they get people thinking, but then a critical difference between them and the Roman model is they would invite non-Christians into their community way before the conversion thing ever happened. And while that's only one step difference when you look at the two charts next to each other, that's a fundamental change in how you do ministry things. Because Christians most Christians fall into this trap of they get surrounded in holy huddle kinds of things, and they don't even know how to bring non-Christians into their life anymore. And to invite them into small groups and into serving things and into these kinds of things before they make a conversion goes against the thinking of many Christians. But, and boy, it's infinitely more messy than the Roman model where, you know, you have the person who's not a Christian, becomes a Christian, and then gets connected, and the purpose is to get them discipled. When you pull them in before all that's been figured out, it gets very, very messy, and it has been very, very messy in Axis. But, I mean, I dig what they did with that thing. You know, I think it's cool. They would invite them into community. And that last one, you'll see, transformation was the final step on this. And what would happen a lot of times is somebody who is very post-Christian, very far from God, they would get awakened, they start thinking about things, they start hanging out in community with Christians, and over time some deep transformation would start to happen. Now again, this is messy because it's so much easier when you just have a line in time where they got converted and became a Christian. But a lot of times this transformation would be the basis for which a Christian could sit down with this non-Christian and say, all right, we need to talk about this. Like, you remember where you used to be 12 months ago, how anti-everything you were? And like, now your value system has started to change, and the way you think has started to change, and you seem very open to Jesus. Like, what's standing in your way of following him? A lot of times the non-Christian stand on the other, sit down there and go, gosh, I don't even really know anymore what's in my way. I guess I'm ready to make that decision. So I think there is always a conversion point still, but it's hard to say where it happens in that process. As we said, sometimes it might be one awakening thing and somebody makes the jump all the way from -8 to Christianity in one jump. Yeah? Sometimes it might be a slow awakening thing where it takes 2 years just to get them open to even the idea of Christianity, and somewhere in the community part they'll do it. You know, it can happen in very different places. A lot of information, huh? I want to show you... you know, my new evangelism strategy with these people, I always have new evangelism strategies. One of them is, if they won't come to church with me, is to get them to do a story at church, and then they have to come. So I'm going to show you a video of Debbie, that girl I talked about, who's had a lot of problems and only gotten her to church one time in her whole life, and it was the time when she came to give her story. But, I mean, to me, she very much represents kind of this messiness of what the Celtic way of doing this evangelism looks like. So here's her story. Oh, wait. Switch tapes.
I'm a third-generation Californian. I grew up in an Italian-Irish Catholic family. Went to Catholic school. Spent all my life in the state of California. I lived up and down the state. I had three wonderful children. And I lost them to violent crime. My daughter was 15 years old, very vivacious, outgoing. She loved life, and she accepted people at face value, just for who they were, not for what they were or what they represented. She had friends from all walks of life. She babysat a lot. Mandy was murdered 2 days before her 16th birthday by a United States Marine. She was trying to protect the lady she babysat for, who was Mr. Underwood's ex-girlfriend. He showed up there early Friday morning, and Mandy tried to prevent him from hurting Rosalie, and it cost her life very, very violently. We marked our 10th anniversary August 2nd of this year, and Mandy's birthday, her 26th birthday, would have been August 4th. Her birthdays are very empty and lonely, and August 2nd is the day that I just dread coming every year. I have issues with God. Okay, I never understood why God would give you the privilege of having a child and then take her away in such a violent act. It makes you want him to come down face to face and tell you why. Because you try to be good, you raise your children well, you teach them about God, you baptize them, and for this to happen to my child, it makes you not want to believe in God. God has a reason for everything he does. You just have to search for the answers to your own personal satisfaction, because it's not going to be handed down on a mountain like Moses. You have to look, you have to seek, and find your own answers as to why.
Kind of wild, huh? Debbie, she's one of my favorite people, partly because she just doesn't fit any box I have. And I did get her to Access that night. And it was so funny. I went and grabbed her as soon as this was over, and she was like shaking. She's like so nervous to be in this church. She's like, I need a beer and a cigarette. I need a beer and a cigarette. I need a beer and a cigarette. I'm like, let's go, let's go, let's go. So we shoot out of there and went to a little corner pub to kind of debrief the whole experience. And she got her beer and cigarette and calmed down a little bit and just talked about what it was like for her to be at that. And she was so nervous to be in a church. Like, she really thought the walls were going to come down on her. She's at an extreme background. She was literally raised by Hell's Angels. Her dad was a Hell's Angel. She's been on a motorcycle since she was a kid. She said in junior high, she went to a Catholic church one time, heard that it's kind of about how much you've done wrong or done good. She said, man, I'm so far behind the eight ball already, I got no chance. Stop going after that. And then on top of that, these kinds of things that have happened to her, I mean, she's... I don't think necessarily most post-Christian people are probably as far back as she is, but I'm hoping that with God's help and through our friendship, she's slowly working up the dial. And man, if I have that mentality of I got to hurry up and get her across the line, I mean, I might as well call time out now. I mean, it's going to be a while before she's ready to make that kind of a decision. But she's come a long way, and I've learned so much through her in this kind of friendship. And I don't know, in my mind, the Celtic Way, very messy, but It helps every person participate in the process, you know. There's no Billy Graham or Luis Palau that's going to raise, I don't think that's going to come up to reach postmodern people. It's going to be each one of our ministries training our people how to do the slow trust building stuff, and within the context of that, sharing Jesus to people.
How do you have a friendship like that without, even in your own mind and then in their mind, somehow... How do you prevent them from feeling like a project?
Yeah,
like,
that's a great question. Okay. I think it's one of the most significant hurdles we face when we're trying to teach our people is there's that weird combination of you do have to be intentional to be evangelistic because nobody goes there naturally, and the worst thing you can do is treat people like a project. And that's rampant. Most Christians, like if you can finally get them to do evangelism, it's like, all right, here's my little evangelism project. You know, he's going to come around with me until he gets saved. And look, everybody, here he is, and someday he's going to be saved. And man, especially at this age, people can sense that from a mile away. I think, first of all, it starts with you and me. Like, I think we have to figure out how to do it with an authentic... Like, I mean, Debbie is not a project to me. I'll tell you what, though, when I started Starbucks, she was. Like, everybody was a project to me when I started Starbucks. And when 3 months went by and nobody responded at all, I was ready to bolt. I'm like, you know, let me shake the dust off my feet and move to a place where people are more open to this. And I'm sure I've learned infinitely more at Starbucks than any of them. I know that because none of them have responded yet, but I know I've learned a lot at my time at Starbucks. And that's probably the single biggest thing I learned is that these people matter to God desperately. And just because they don't fit my grid of how quickly they need to come to Christ doesn't mean they matter any less. And that, frankly, if I'm going to live out, you know, Jesus, Luke 19:10, he says, my mission is to seek and save those who are lost. And I love that wording because, you know, seekers, that's like the word we use for non-Christians, right? Like, it's their job to seek and our job to answer them. When I read Luke 19:10 where it says, I've come to seek and save the lost, I thought, man, there's a seeker in this verse, but it's not the non-Christian. It's Jesus, and it's because he truly cared about these people. And so I want to be known as a seeker for the rest of my life who does it for the right reasons, not for the wrong reasons. Now, I do need bursts of intentionality to do that, but I believe it can be done, you know, with a heart that's purely motivated. And once I get that straight, then I can help other people because I can call it out in them when I see it. So I think it starts with all of us saying, are we purely motivated seeking out people that don't know him and doing that trust building stuff and just helping them see Jesus? Does that help at all? Or I don't know if I have a concrete answer to say, here's how you don't move in. I mean, it's just a hard thing.
It just seems like because you're an evangelist, I mean, you are, and you're going to be intentional about all different kinds of friendships. And it seems like there's a limit to how many
Absolutely. I don't. I wouldn't say I have friendships with more than two or three people in all of Starbucks. I'll have a passing conversation here or there. I can't. Two to three is absolutely stretching for me. Absolutely stretching. And that's why I had to come to a place like the only way anything's going to happen in Axis is if multiple people of us are doing it. Because I'm not going to be the Starbucks evangelist who goes from Starbucks to Starbucks and saves these people. Obviously. You know, it's like my friends are leading more people to Christ than I am. I know anybody who knows me, or a lot of people would say I'm an evangelist. I actually don't think I am. I was so stone cold towards evangelism 6 years ago, I never had a fleeting thought even about lost people mattering to God. And it's really been Bill Hybels and his teaching. Like, my heart has transformed over time. And it's like, this is my spiritual gift, so I need to do it. Like, this is, something changed in me over the last 6 years. And so therefore, I believe it can happen to anybody where they live with that kind of an intensity for people who don't know God. I believe it. I'm banking everything on it that the average person can get there.
One thing that made a big difference with our students was that they, through our relationship, learned that we were going to love them whether they ever...
Yeah, that's a big thing to say. You can say no to God for the entirety of our friendship and it's not going to change things.
I'm not going to be a Christian, so I'm out here.
Mm-hmm.
This is loving them, and they know it.
And it's a big freedom for me. I don't feel the pressure like I have to show fruitfulness to people. I just have to show faithfulness to the people God's given me. Because if I was showing fruitfulness, I would have ditched these people and tried to look for people more open. And I mean, that's just the wrong way for me to go about it. It's my job to be salt and light to them. It's God's job to figure out the rest. But I got to take it as far as I can and love them in a true way. So, I mean, I'm never telling stories at Axis of people that have come to know God. I think I've led one person to the Lord my whole life. You know, if you go by that, I shouldn't be up here. You know, I mean, it's. But I just don't think that's what God's called me to do. He's called me to get around those post-Christian people that are way far away, and maybe I take them from -8 to -6, and then God brings somebody else in. Yeah.
I've worked with students for several years now in the campus ministry, and I just wanted to affirm what you're saying. The last 5 or 6 years, those people, students that have come to know Christ, it has taken so much longer. They built so many relationships. They had to come to so many things. I just wonder if they're ever going to get there.
Yeah.
You can see that God just draws them along. I can give you a lot of stories.
Yeah. And it's hard being, I don't know if you guys are in these kind of cultures, at Willow, we're such a numbers-oriented culture that we measure everything, and it's hard to measure trust building that's slow. And I love the church to death, but it's a challenge to be doing this kind of ministry where it seems like everybody, it's a 2 to 5 year process. And, you know, and at Willow, they're having 600 baptisms every year and stuff, and I just go, God, either we're doing something wrong or things are different, you know, and it's not easy trying to... be in that kind of an environment that measures those kinds of things, but trying to figure out. Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts practically on how you can impart this kind of passion to other students?
Yeah, I mean, I think when I think of evangelism training, this is a simple way, but there's a why and a how. You know, so first you have to get people. There's nothing worse than somebody's doing evangelism because they're supposed to. Like, that just does not last. And there will always be a little bit of supposed to, but in the extreme guilt sense, like, that, you know, it's just, that will never be fruitful because there's not going to be genuine friendship. So, I mean, just teaching constantly on it, you know. Luke 19:10, the mission of Jesus. Luke 15, the three lost things that matter to him. All throughout the scriptures. I mean, Jesus, I mean, he was a radical evangelist, you know. He spent his life with poor people and lost people and then taught his disciples how to do the same thing. And so, teach on that a lot, and that needs to be, I think, kind of an upfront thing. But then there's a training piece of like, okay, so they get fired up, what do we do? And I won't really take any time to go over it, but you'll see a sheet on the back. That's our strategy. And the reason I didn't spend much time on this yet, it's a river. We call it the river because it's kind of a non-linear way in that, you know, postmodern evangelism, I think, does not always go in order, but these tend to be elements. And like, this is the reason I spent so much time on the Celtic enrollment is, like, it's all from this. Like, we just said, how do we put together a strategy that reflects the trust-building process? And so we do a 3-week training. We go into small groups because if we do a centralized training, they never come to it. So we have to say, we're going to your small group to train you on it, whether you want us there or not. And we do a 3-week training. Week one is that first part of develop a friendship. Man, it is so hard to get our Christians to do this, to develop friendships with people that don't know God. They know them at school, they know them at work, but they're not friends with them. They have contact relationships. So I actually go through this pre-Christian and post-Christian the same way we did here. I ask them, are your friends more pre-Christian or post-Christian? Every time, 80% of them say more post-Christian. Say, there's only one way you reach a post-Christian friendship, and that's being a friend to them. That's a friendship that is not dependent on them making a decision for Christ. It's a friendship because God loves them and therefore you love them. So we take an entire week to train on that. It's been a big learning for us. That used to be just kind of, well, that's just a duh, right? So let's go to the how. found out that's not a duh. That's really hard for people to move in that direction. In week two, we do, I mean, I think it's very important that people can share their journey. You know, in a postmodern culture where truth is relative, the one thing you can say with confidence is my story. The only problem is, for most Christians that have grown up in a church, how good are they at telling their story? They're terrible at it, right? I mean, it's like, when I was 6 years old, I stole from my sister and realized I was a sinner in need of a Savior, so therefore I, you know, accepted Jesus in my heart. I mean, they don't feel like there's any drama to it, and we don't help any, because the stories we put up here all the time are the rock and roll drug addicts who had the dramatic conversion, and that's great, but then every normal Christian says, man, that ain't my story. So I will show you this. This is just a very simple way we've taught people to do, how to tell their story. It's something I adapted from Rick Richardson. But we just teach them these three circles. And this is the whole way we teach them to do their story. And we say, all right, circle one is God in the center of the circle. And just simply put, this is what God's intent is for every single person that He has created. He wants to be at the center of their lives. Part two, you'll see it's just an empty circle with God on the outside, and this is where it becomes very individual for them. We say every one of us has pushed God out of the center. That's the biblical word sin. We replace God with something else. So when I tell this story, I talk about my journey. I grew up in a Christian home, so I thought I had no story. The reality is I totally strayed from God from like 14 to 22. In the quest for money and power, I mean, that was a real thing. That was my story, and I felt God wouldn't let me get there. So that was what was in the middle for me. For some people, it's a girl or a boy. For some people, it's a car. For some people, it's a behavior pattern. But so we teach the Christians, what is it that was, when God has been pushed out of the center, what is it that was in the middle for you? And incidentally, it's a great question to ask non-Christians too, because when I tell my story, I'll always ask them, you know, would you say God's in the center of your circle? Well, no. Well, what's in the middle of your circle? I had a guy just a few weeks ago say, happiness is what's in the center of my circle. That's more important than God right now. Yeah. So that's where they really kind of customize their story. And we find even if they're a long-term Christian, they're very easily able to say, there's probably a lot of things, but if there's at least this one thing that has been characteristic of me that pushes God out. And then part three is, God wants us to get back to that original place where we are a follower of Him, where He is at the center of everything we do. And we tell, and if it's a Christian, how you tell your story, we say, what is it that pushed you to want to put Him back at the center? And they tell their story through that context. I found it to be very helpful because for people that have grown up in church or for people that didn't have a real clean conversion date, like it was on this moment that I bowed the knee, the typical method of here's who I was before Christ, here's when I made the decision, here's after Christ, it doesn't work for them. So this is how we teach them to share their journey. So in week two, we teach them this, and then we teach them the bridge diagram, because ultimately, eventually, their friend will say, so how does somebody become a Christian? And are you guys all familiar with the bridge diagram, I'm assuming? So that's week two. So you see, pretty simple stuff. You know, I mean, it's not hardcore, but always reinforcing this trust building. Then week three is where we say, now, there's really two directions your friends will probably go. They may be open to going to church, and that's fantastic if they are. Like, we put a lot of resources in that access to having a service that's accessible to non-Christian people. And I find for one out of every five non-Christians, all it takes is just somebody being a friend, and they're open to coming to church. And that's, our fruitfulness has been those one out of five people. But it can be deceiving because you think you're doing a good job and you're missing four out of five. So then that's when we really push, we call them pre-church experiences. We spent all that time in the awakening stuff. That's all this awakening stuff is figuring out what are the pre-church experiences you can do for your friend. So gigs is a significant thing we're pushing that we got from InterVarsity, which is just one-on-one Bible studies that you do with non-Christians in the context of friendship. I mean, that's a very awakening thing if you can get them to read the Bible. Because again, the problem is oftentimes with church, not with God. So if you could say, hey, do you wonder what Jesus said about sex? Do you wonder what Jesus said about relationships? Do you wonder what Jesus said about work? Let's just study a little thing from it. And then somebody else mentioned the serving things. That's reach. What is reach? We have teams that go out every Saturday of the month to do serving the poor kinds of things. Find that to be tremendously more open to non-Christians than our services sometimes. So that's a long answer to whoever asked that of how we train people around this. But I don't want you to miss the fact it was sitting in a room with our core leader saying, what does evangelism look like in this generation? What's missing? Kind of come up with this, that's trust building thing, and then the awakening thing being where we have to get stronger. And then we crafted this strategy around that. Any other questions? Got just a couple more minutes. Yeah.
Would you say on the community thing under the Celtic model, that spans the trust from person to person to person to larger group of people?
Absolutely, I think so. Sometimes so many people have misconception about Christians that they just think they're all weird. So it helps when, you know, I meet them and now that's one person that hopefully they don't think is weird. But if I can introduce them to some of my other Christian friends, like that's a big thing for them, just simply to see they're normal people. One of the guys at Starbucks, his name is Matt. This is unbelievable. He's 24 years old. I just got him to play basketball at Willow with me last month. It's the first time he's ever stepped foot in a church before. 24. I've never been to a wedding, never been to a funeral, never been to a church service for anything. So play basketball with me. And now I've got three other Christian guys playing, and it's just us, and we just goof around, play two-on-two or horse. But like, I mean, this has been a big deal for him that Christians are normal people. And he's like Debbie. He's a long way away. Gosh, it just... it's painful thinking about how long it's going to take for him to get it, you know. But, you know, we're just starting. It's that same stuff. Awakening community, awakening community, awakening community. And I think if every person would just keep thinking about how can I do something awakening for my friend, how can I build trust in the sense of community, and I just think every person could be fruitful in the sense of pushing people towards Christ.
At this point, what you're discussing is, it seems to be theory as in validated logically, good theory. Have you seen some fruit? Some stuff. I mean, it certainly makes sense.
Yeah. It's funny. We've almost given up on that. Here I am. I'm kind of going against the altar call kind of thing because part of it's just never worked for us in Axis. We just had our first ever. I mean, we've never had more than three people in an Axis service respond. The last Target thing we did, we had 72 people come to Christ. But like, it would be such a mistake to think it's just because our service was so good. Like, I think we are now really starting to reap fruit of doing this for about a year and a half. So it's by far the most significant number of people. And it's cool, I know a lot of the stories, and they are people that were way far away from God. So I feel like we're just getting to the place we're seeing fruit. But then, like the gig thing, which is central to us of doing this thing, like we've launched like five of them ever in Axis, so that one is still more theory for us. But I am, you're right, a lot of this is somewhat theory. I believe it's true, but it takes time to, yeah, that's, I mean, the Willow people are asking the same thing you're saying. Yeah, this all sounds great. Let's see it working. So I believe we're right on the edge of seeing a lot more of these kinds of conversions happen because our people have been doing this for about a year and a half now. Yeah?
Do you have to change what you expect to be, quote, working? In other words, when people will say, well, let's see it work,
yeah,
they come maybe with a whole different understanding of what it means to have something,
yeah,
working than what, like you said, well, a year and a half later, we start seeing some real...
Right.
Conversions and stuff like that.
It helps. I think Willow's starting to get it because they're starting to sense this post-Christian thing more and more in their context too. So it helped. Like they give us a long leash to work with. So they've been pretty gracious with us. So you're right. You almost need like a full-time translator just to help the two groups understand each other. But yeah. Hey, maybe one more question. And I'll stick around for anybody that has. Yeah.
Is it possible for you to change your definition of what working is?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
in the sense that you don't know when certain ones you going to work. In that context, when you're planning,
yeah,
you don't know what's
happening. Dude, I hang on to that one, man. I wouldn't be at Starbucks if the definition of working is people coming to know God. I mean, really, I'm at 2 years. That's a long time to be scrubbing on the floors and making cappuccino and nobody's doing anything. But I believe with all my heart that it's working, that people are slowly moving towards Jesus. But, man, you wouldn't know it on the outside. So I'm making everything on that different definition of working, that all I can do is the best I know how to represent Christ to people and pray that something I say or do, God uses that to get through their thick exterior. Let me say a prayer for you guys as you guys go on this, and I'll stick around as long as you have questions. So thank you for coming out, and I appreciate your energy. Dear Heavenly Father, we are so grateful to be included as sons and daughters of your family. And boy, you know, in this whole evangelism thing, you could just call people directly to yourself and just avoid us in the process because it gets much more messy with us. Yet you give us the challenge and the command to rediscover the church for our generation. So I pray we'll be faithful to that, trusting in the guidance of your Holy Spirit, but to figure out what is different about our people today and how do we represent you well and make you famous all over this world, God, and help people find you. So I pray that in each ministry represented here that they will have a fresh encounter with you and maybe even a couple good ideas from this conference and go back and just be salt and light in amazing ways. So we love you, God. Thank you for this chance to be part of this. In your name, amen.